All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of Free for All. This is your host, Big John, and tonight we have a very special guest, our good friend of the show, and also the Libertarian Party candidate for president in 2024, Mr. Chase Oliver. Chase, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I've been enjoying the holiday season here in Atlanta with friends and family. So it's been a good time post-election.
And it's a good way to wind down after that arduous campaign and campaigning in general. And also, I may note, a member of a goatee club now post-election, I see, that you grew in a goatee after the election.
Yeah, you know, you get to relax shaving so much when you're no longer running for office. So I figure why not let it grow out? No shave November, as it were, and now we're into December. So we'll just see how long it goes.
Fantastic, fantastic. And everyone, please feel free. Chase is here. We're going to be talking to him, but also feel free to leave your questions. If you're on YouTube, X, Facebook, or Rumble, feel free to leave your questions in the chat. We will see them live, and we'll ask Chase your questions. Chase has already said, feel free to ask him anything. He's very upfront, very transparent, and that's one of the things we love about him. So, Chase, let's start out with the obvious. Give me your feelings about the campaign. Now, from the very beginning, I always said you were one of the guys that I was rooting for. You and Mike, I thought, were a fantastic ticket. Mike, also a friend of the show. We've had him here several times while you guys were also on the road. Talk to me about the campaign, your campaign stop in New York. I came down to see you down in the Village in New York City. We had a good conversation there. Tell me about the campaign, how a little bit of the personal side of it. How draining was it? I know you toured, was it all 50 states or 48 contiguous states? How was that?
I hit Alaska and Hawaii, too. I traveled to all 50 states, both in seeking the nomination as well as post-nomination, if you put that all in total. In many states, of course, I hit multiple times. It is a draining thing. Like I said, it's been kind of rejuvenating being at home, staying in the same bed for multiple nights in a row, right? Not waking up and going, okay, what town am I in again? What am I doing today? And so, you know, it is definitely something that does drain you. But ultimately, it was, probably the honor of my life to do. You know, I told people I'm not married. I don't have kids yet. So this is probably the most momentous thing that I'll be doing in my life thus far. And it was a wild ride and I enjoyed it. And glad Mike was along for the ride as well. You know, he was busy too, traveling all over the place. So I'm very thankful that I had a running mate who was able to stay busy.
Yeah, and honestly, I've said it from the start. I think that the last, say, four or five presidential campaigns, rather, I think the LP has fielded very capable, I use the air quotes, professional campaigns. Folks that we could be proud of and maybe not even monolithic necessarily, representing the entire spectrum of libertarianism for the most part. So I wanted to thank you and Mike for continuing that recent trend of professional campaigns, in my opinion. Now, the results weren't anywhere what we had hoped they would be. The national tally for you and Mike came in at just under 0.5% nationally. I was hoping you guys could, and I thought you guys could pull out 1% as a matter of positioning, especially in a difficult campaign. Tell me what happened. Is there anything specific that you can sort of point to? Because that is something that critics within the LP, and when you talk about those that sort of intra-party sort of wrangling, but, you know, that's something people will throw at you, like, hey, Chase and Mike had the worst showing in recent campaign cycles. Talk to me about that. Tell me, is there anything you would have done different? What were there factors that you feel were mitigating that caused a little bit of that depressed performance? Tell me a little bit about that. Oh, it looks like Chase may have frozen up a little bit. Let's see if we can get him to come back on. Okay, so I'll try to kill some time here while Chase is trying to get back on the stage. That is one of the issues, and that hopefully Chase will come back to address. He was having a little bit of connectivity issues. His critics. And I see him setting up, so I'll bring him back on the stage in a second or two. All right, let's hold.
Hey, sorry about that. We're doing it from my phone because my laptop just decided to. It was already, near death. I'm going to have to pull the old Yeller move and take it out back and shoot it after this podcast. So,
I was going to say, being a good libertarian, at least you're properly prepared for the old Yeller moment. I'm sure you're armed properly.
Exactly. I got
Georgia,
this.
Right? Okay.
But you were asking about expectations in the race and vote totals and where we're at. Well, first, I just want to put into perspective like where we're at amongst libertarian campaigns. So we've had 14 campaigns. We are the fifth highest vote total, fourth highest performing candidate. So in terms of raw numbers of votes, we're just under 0.5%. We're kind of right there. Dr. Paul in 88 had 0.47%. So we're kind of right in that median area. But what's amazing about that is we did so with about $500,000 in the campaign. Yes. And so we did so with less resources of any libertarian campaign since 1972, since John Hosper's the first one. And that's not adjusted for inflation, that's in real dollars. And I think the explanation for that is kind of twofold. First, a lot of that alternative party energy was very much in the Robert Kennedy camp up until Labor Day. People who normally would be donating to libertarians or the Green Party or the Constitution Party or any other alternative party saw the last name Kennedy, saw a lot of PAC money getting behind him and thought, okay, that's where I'm going to invest my alternative party money. And maybe by Labor Day, a lot of those people were like tapped out. They were not ready to continue donating elsewhere or whatever. And we just weren't able to capitalize on that the way past libertarian campaigns have. Now, what we did do is run a very, very lean and mean campaign, myself and Mike. And in doing so, I think we were the only presidential campaign that actually earned more votes than dollars spent across the board. And so we did median for a libertarian, right in the middle of the pack, but we did so with like less than half the resources of any other campaign that have ever run as a libertarian before. So all in all, with all the headwinds, including some internal party headwinds, that's a whole thing that no other campaign for a libertarian has had to face before. Yes. I think we did quite well, actually, all things considered.
Right. And I don't want to gloss over that. I want to save a couple of minutes later to discuss those intra-party struggles, as you mentioned. But as you toured the nation, as you went from state to state, as you said, 50 states, all 50 states, quite the achievement, I might add. I'm not sure if Spike and Joe did the same thing in last cycle. I don't think they did. I'm not even sure if Gary Johnson and William Weld did. So, and especially, like you said, on a constrained budget, I forget who your assistant was when you were here in New York City, but he was passing the laptop around saying, hey, we accept Bitcoin. And you had your campaign. I forget the name of the pub, but it was a Bitcoin pub. Pub Key, in the Village. Yes, it was all very libertarian. It was a fun evening to be at. So certainly no one can accuse you of not knowing how to make a Bitcoin or a dollar stretch. I think you did a good campaign of that. Now, as you were campaigning, of the crowds you did speak to, of the people you did address, and I know you shook a lot of hands. You guys were very open. Did you get a sense that people were more or less accepting of the libertarian message that you were putting out there? Or was it too fragmented, like you said, for RFK or for the Greens or from what the Mises Caucus was trying to sell?
Well, I think a lot of people were very receptive to the message. They were very happy to hear from an alternative. And especially when you were doing that kind of on the ground retail politicking, folks were very happy to engage and approach things with an open mind. And so I think there was just a lot of, and I don't know if that translates into votes, right? Because at the end of the day, I think a lot of people ended up falling into the Trump or the Harris camp out of fear of the other, right? They were very much sold on, if Kamala Harris wins election, it'll be Karl Marx run amok. And if Donald Trump wins the election, it'll be Mussolini reborn. Like there was this very much like fear base out of both of them. And that drove a lot of voters into the arms of the mainstream, which is why we had the lowest number of alternative votes, I think, in like the last several election cycles, even including RFK. When you look at that, Jill Stein, the Libertarians, even the other minor party candidates, like all as a combined, were less of a vote share than alternative parties have in the past. I think that was a that was because many voters were based out of fear. Even though they loved engaging with me and talking the issues, they were very open-minded and kind. I think at the end of the day, when they went to the ballot box, many people were like, ooh, I just got to vote for Harris because I don't want Trump, or I just got to vote for Trump because I don't want Harris. Right. And there just wasn't a lot of elbow room in the alternative party space, even once RFK got out. It was already a very tight space when RFK jumped in, and it didn't really let up.
And when you kind of saw that, did you get it? It really was the lesser of two evils fallacy, right? That people really were just. I agree with you, by the way, and I think that was fairly obvious. I'm a little bit fascinated by the effect RFK had. So I would have thought that the typical progression was here's RFK. Anti-establishment, whatever you may think of him, he was certainly the anti-establishment candidate that garnered the most attention, certainly polls-wise he was, that when he decided to align himself with Trump after getting rebuffed by the Democrats, I would have thought that, hey, these people would have been, hey, he's a poser all along. He was trying to sell out to one party or the other. And yet, rather than have that, what I would have thought in prior election cycles would have been that sort of reflexive, hey, this guy was a poser. I'm going back to the Libertarian. I'm going back to the Greens. They followed him to Trump. Did you find that to be a peculiar reaction to the way the whole RFK campaign played itself out?
Well, you know, some certainly did follow him to Trump. Some stayed and voted for him, inexplicably enough in a lot of states. Right. And some just stayed at home. And then there are some who came to vote for the Libertarian. I can tell you right now, the week after RFK got out, that Labor Day week, I did events in Ohio. And at every event I did, there were several people who came up and said, we were RFK voters. We're now Libertarian voters. We're not going to vote with the party. We're disappointed in him for dropping out. We were very much behind him, but now we just can't be. I imagine there were some people who just could not vote for Donald Trump or Kamala Harris who did pull the lever for RFK because they thought that was their guy. And even though he wasn't running, they still just couldn't bring themselves to pull a lever for the two-party system. And I empathize so much with those folks and wish they'd come out and voted for the Libertarian, right? Because if they had joined the 600,000 votes, if our votes had been put together, it would have been well over a million votes. That would have made a great statement. But instead, you know, it just ended up the way it was. But, you know, I don't fault people for that. And by the way, for those who might be decrying vote totals, right, I got fifth place, right, behind RFK and Jill Stein. Now, so did Harry Brown in 2000. He got fifth place but behind the Reform Party candidate and the Green Party candidate, Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan, Ralph Nader, respectively, rather. Right. He's still one of the greatest libertarian communicators we've ever had. And so I'm not going to say I'm Harry Brown or anything. I don't like to make comparisons. But what I'm saying is vote totals are not the sole determination of whether you're a great libertarian candidate or great libertarian communicator or not. In fact, I would argue he is a better communicator than just about every other libertarian candidate we've ever had, regardless of vote total.
Or even look, for those folks that are so I'm too old to have been enamored by him, but Ron Paul, you know, for everybody that is sort of denigrating your campaign within the Libertarian Party, again, we'll come to those folks later. The person that they aspire to, Ron Paul, you know, like you said, basically the same vote total in terms of percentage of the popular vote as Ron Paul. So and that's after he had been in Congress for several terms as a Republican. Right. So and I doubt.
And without a bunch of other third parties, he was the only third party in a majority of presidential ballots, as opposed to we had a very crowded field in 2024. Yes. It was I never want to say the most important election of our lifetime, right? That's the stupidest thing. All elections are important. There's not one that's going to be more but definitely the most unique election, I think, of my lifetime in terms of the crowded field, Joe Biden dropping out and having Kamala Harris jump in kind of midway through the Butler, Pennsylvania, as well as the Trump golf course attempts. Like these things really change the dynamic of a race.
that I just don't think we've ever seen before. So not the most important race of our lifetime, but definitely the most unique, I think. And I don't just say that as a participant. I would have said that as an outside observer as well. Yeah. If we were looking at like Mike Tremont and Lars Mapstead as the ticket, right, instead of me,
yeah.
I would still be saying, what a weird race that was.
Yeah, and look, I've got a couple of years on you, so I might be able to point to the 1980 race when you had those attempts. And certainly towards the end of Carter's administration, there were attempts on his life that were kind of weird, too, that kind of bled over. But I do get your point. It's well taken. It was a weird election cycle. And certainly the RFK, sort of like the Ross Perot wild card was in the 90s. Let me ask you this, though. As you're going through it now, in terms of positioning the Libertarian Party, do you feel you position the Libertarian Party, now again, not always about winning. I'm a firm believer in, yes, it's a political party. Our goal should be to win. But if your only goal is to win, go be a Republican or a Democrat. I'll steal that from my good friend Larry Sharp, who says that all the time, right? But do you feel that by running the campaign the way you did, the way you and Mike did you accomplish what your goals were for putting out the Libertarian message to the country, to the people out there pulling the levers?
Well, you know, I think to the extent that we could get the message out in that very crowded field and with the limited resources we had, I think we created a positive name ID. Like, I think Mike and myself both comported ourselves in a very professional manner. I think we did a great job with whatever media we could get. Like, you know, I still regularly get people who are sending me messages going, hey, I just checked out that Stossel interview, even if it's after the election. It was great, right? So, like, we did a great job with what we were able to do. And if you look at some of the exit polling, you know, what limited people did know of us, we had a pretty positive name ID, particularly with younger voters. That was our highest base of support in terms of positive name identification. And I think that's a good thing, because if you're not mining into the younger voters as an alternative party, you're really doing yourself a disservice, because it's way harder to get those middle-aged voters who have been voting Republican or Democrat for, you know, 20 years, as opposed to, you know, a fresh voter who's 18 to 21 years old in their first election. And they're like, hey, I'll vote for the alternative. And wake people up to that kind of, you know, the realization that they don't have to be limited to two choices. Right. So I think we did a pretty good job of that. And again, you know, we did get pretty, you know, I use the Minnesota State Fair as a great example. We were just, I was walking around the Minnesota State Fair with their candidate for U.S. Senate, who's she was an Iraq war vet, anti-war voice, very much in line with a lot of the beliefs I have there. And we were recognized a couple times, not just her, but me as well, just regular Minnesotans walking around.
Right.
And so if we were able to break through, you know, I got recognized at the airport on the way flying home from Dallas after the election by a random person who was like, hey, I voted for you. So there was some amount of permeation that happened if random strangers are coming up to you, hey, I voted for you, right? So I think we did a great job with what we had. And like I said, I'm very proud of my campaign. And it's not just me. It's not just Mike. It's a whole team of people who really busted their ass, if I may say so, to really bring about a lot of really hard work to come to fruition. I'm very proud of them.
Yeah, you did. And to be honest with you, I got the, as you know, as we're doing the show, you'd appear on the podcast and I'd go talk to people afterwards. Hey, what'd you think of Chase? What'd you think of Mike? The responses I got, even from my partner, William, here at Grumblings Media, who's a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, you know, he would say, you know, I don't necessarily agree with everything Mike and Chase have to say, but I will say one thing. They're impressive candidates. They could, you could tell they're putting in the hard work. They're going out. They're shaking hands. They're going to rallies. They're going to campaign events. And I think that's something that plagued the Libertarian Party, say, in the 90s and the early aughts, you know, where our candidates, our process were seen almost as a joke, you know, in some cases. Not even necessarily the messaging, just the performative aspect of it. But you guys did do a good job like that. Let me ask you this. In New York, I couldn't vote for you guys. No ballot access for the Libertarian Party in New York. I had to go write your name in. And I think, was it Illinois was the other state that had no ballot access?
Yeah, I think so far we're seeing over, I think we've counted over 3,000 votes so far in Illinois so far. So the write-in votes are starting to be counted finally.
Okay. Tell me about that. Ballot access. Do you feel that that is something, I mean, obviously all third party candidates are going to say that's something we have to somehow figure out. How do we legitimately get contending parties to get the proper ballot access in all 50 states? So give me your thoughts on that. What suggestions would you have going forward for that?
Well, there's a few. I think we need to tackle certain ballot access laws that exist that are just very flawed and make it very hard for alternative parties to get on the ballot. New York and Illinois are probably two of the harshest in terms of the presidential race. New York raised their threshold and shortened their window. And another thing that I think is really wrong is that a lot of states have a law where if you sign the ballot petition for one candidate, it doesn't get counted for another if you sign a ballot petition for another candidate. And I think that's completely wrong. If I'm a voter, I should be able to sign a petition for as many candidates as I want choices on the ballot. I should say I want 10 choices on the ballot if I want to, because I'm a voter. And my voice should not be limited to only supporting one extra voice on the ballot. That's not fair to anybody who's not a Republican or a Democrat. And it raises the price of signature gathering because it creates a limited number of people you can get to gather signatures. And then you also have a limited number of petitioners you can hire. So it really raises the cost and becomes very prohibitive towards having alternative voices. And New York saw this with the fact that there were only two choices written on the ballot for them in this presidential race. And I think it should outrage New Yorkers, Illinoisans, and everywhere else to say we need to lower our thresholds. There were three states where I was on the ballot. Tennessee was more of a matter of a lot of our signatures got thrown out. It was a very low threshold we needed, but we gathered what we thought we needed, and then the state tossed enough out to remove us from the ballot. But even in that case, that was to run as an independent, not to run as a libertarian, and it wouldn't have garnered vote totals towards the Libertarian Party of Tennessee, which I think is also wrong. We shouldn't have different standards for an independent, for a libertarian, and for a Republican and Democrat. If I have to go garner signatures, the same should be said of the Republicans and Democrats in every state. You shouldn't get automatic access. And we should really equalize this entire thing by lowering the amount of signatures you need, lowering the cost of running for office, and making it more doable. But, these are steps that are going to have to be taken across party coalitions. Like, this isn't just a libertarian problem. Right. And I'm willing to join with the Greens, the Constitutions, the No Labels, the Forward Party, anybody outside the Republicans and Democrats, or including Republicans and Democrats, who want to see a fair political process.
Sure, but why would they? There's no upside to them joining your coalition, Chase, obviously.
Not without ranked choice voting, there isn't. If there's ranked choice voting, they might be willing to do it to say, hey, let's garner those votes in the second round and win our election.
So talk to me about RCV for the people that aren't quite familiar with it. Ranked choice voting means you go in and you have X number of slots to fill out. So it's almost like the MVP voting on in a baseball or football, right? You say, here's the guy I want to win, but here's my second choice and here's my third, gold, silver, bronze, right? And up to X number of candidates, right? Talk to me about the mechanics of that.
Yeah, basically what you're looking to get in a ranked choice voting election is a candidate who has over 50% of the vote to win. You need to have over 50% of the vote, so meaning nominal support from at least half of the electorate or more. And in many races, when you have more than two candidates, the winner in a plurality election has like 46% or 47%. So how do you get to that 50%? Well, you take off the vote of the lowest vote getter. So let's say there's three candidates, a Democrat, a Republican, and a Libertarian, right?
Right.
Harris, Biden, and Trump, right? Or I'm sorry, Harris, Trump, and myself.
Right.
That's the three of us, right?
Yeah.
The two candidates, they're both in the 40s, and I've garnered 6% of the vote, right? Well, in a ranked choice vote, my 6% would then no longer count for me in the second round, and it would go to whoever you mark second, your silver choice candidate on that ballot. So maybe half, more than half of my voters say, okay, I want Trump as my second choice. Gotcha. And then Trump ends up winning because he gets over 50% of the vote. Well, that's how ranked choice voting works. It allows for at least the candidate to win to have nominal support from over half of the voters. This is one style of what I call an advanced voting model. There's also approval voting, star voting. There's all different types. And some apply better than others. Like, I love approval voting for city councils. Hey, we have 15 candidates and 5 seats. Well, I'm going to mark the people that I approve of to sit on that city council, whether it's one person or 10 people. And then whoever gets the most approval votes, well, that's the top 5 that makes it. Like, that's a great way to seat a city council that gets approval from the majority, from the broad spectrum of the voters. Like, I think that is so these are models that we can look at to improve the way we vote and have a heck of a lot better candidates. Also, by the way, in ranked choice voting, when I'm that third place candidate, guess who's going to walk up to my voters and say, here's what we're going to give you. You don't have to have our candidate come to our convention. We don't have to sell out. We don't have to do anything like that. They'll come to us because they need us in that second round.
Right.
And so it creates a respect for that alternative party. And they're a little bit more civic to us. They're not liable to call us kooks or crazy people when they know they need our votes in the second round.
Right. And that's and you know, the RCD, the ranked choice voting you just mentioned is probably just one way. You could also do it like the other way, like first place gets X percentage of a full vote. Second place gets the next, you know, like 10, 7, 5, whatever, those old combinatorial.
There's a lot of models. There's a lot of models that are better than plurality.
Right. But the actual concept there is you're getting a better flavor for more widespread support as opposed to this all or nothing where.
Yeah.
And really.
Great example. Great example you can use is like, have you ever been out to like with like three people and you're all going out to dinner and you're like, hey guys, what does everybody want? And like everybody's first choice is different, but everybody's second choice is like Italian food. Right. And then you're like, okay, well, everybody's going to be fine with Italian. We're going to go to Italian, right? That's kind of how ranked choice voting works in kind of the abstract.
Right, right. No, and that's a great point. And actually, when you caused the Senate runoff in Georgia, was that ranked choice voting there or was it? That you had just caused them to be under 50%.
Yeah, so a runoff is kind of like a delayed ranked choice vote, right? So it basically, instead of automatically flowing your vote to the next column, you have to go back and vote again, except for the overseas and military voters in Georgia. They voted using a ranked choice ballot because they knew they couldn't get the second ballot back and enough, quickly enough. And so they just said, put your first choice first, put your second choice in case your first choice is eliminated due to the runoff rules. And so if it was good enough for the GIs and the overseas voters in Georgia and they could get it, I think we could adopt this in Georgia, which would have saved the state, you know, millions of dollars from having to run another election.
I'm all for anything that gets people more choices, gets more options in there. So I think that's a great idea. All right, now let's quickly go to a question. And even if it wasn't in the order that I would have had the show, Linda, what does your future hold for you? Will you seek the nomination again? If so, how do you make peace with the Mises Caucus? So Chase, those are a lot of questions in there in one comment from Linda. So let me just break them a little bit down for you, maybe put them in some logical order in the context that we were saying right now. So in terms of the Mises Caucus, the Libertarian National Committee, LNC, post-convention. I said this on the show several times. I've been blocked by the chair, by the vice chair. Everybody else on the LNC has blocked me except for one or two people because I came out and said, like, okay, you had a hard-fought convention. Chase and Mike came out on top. I get it. You weren't happy with those results as the chair. You support your candidate. You don't put on a clown nose. You don't say in certain states vote for Trump, other states vote for Chase because he might hurt Biden. We don't enter into agreements with RFK. We don't try to invite other parties' candidates, which I still don't understand is how that's not a violation of the bylaws. Talk to me about that. The LP is fractured right now.
It certainly is. And. Yeah. There's a lot of work to be done. So let me kind of answer all three of those questions. So first, will I seek the nomination again? If the party is in a position to properly support a presidential ticket, absolutely I would consider running again because I think I have a lot of value to bring as a candidate. In fact, before I even won the nomination for president, the Libertarian Party gave me an award for such a well-run campaign in my Senate campaign. So I have a pretty effective candidate. I'm pretty young. You know, even if I wait 12 years, I'll still be younger than Kamala Harris if I want to run for president. So like I have plenty of time to consider this. But what am I going to be doing in the meantime? What does the future hold for me? Well, I'm going to be looking to build this party up, to build the Libertarian Party up in states and in our national leadership across the country with those who want to professionalize our party, with those who are going to be focused on professionalism, ethics, and building this party up, not being the JV team for the Republicans, not fighting for a seat at their table, but building our own table, building our own base of power. And that's something that we need to do in a way that we have not done in the 50 plus years we've been a party. We've a lot of times devolved ourselves into philosophical debating or broken ourselves down along caucus lines. Let me be frank. When I go to identify people I want to support for leadership in states and at national across the country, I do not care about your caucus. I don't care who you roll with. I don't care what philosophical wing of libertarianism you come into this party from. I care about. Have you run a business? Have you run a nonprofit? Have you done something successful? And can you apply those lessons to our party to build results? Can you create growth? Can you create a growth in membership, in donors, in influence, in numbers of candidates that we're able to properly support? We supported 400 candidates in this race. I argue we can do 800 in 4 years from now if we build ourselves properly. And so will I make peace with the Mises Caucus? I am entering what I call the post-caucus period of my life. I'm not worrying about caucus anymore. I'm worrying about the Libertarian Party, building up our name ID, and building up effective messengers. Again, I don't care what part of the wing brought you into the party, where you're at. I care about if you're going to compose yourself with professionalism and with ethics, something that in the corporate world is what leads to real professionalism and growth. If we don't have those things, we run a real risk of fading into oblivion. And so that's what I'm focusing on.
I agree with you. And I understand your point about, okay, I'm not going to fracture along caucuses or but there is very much the reality right now. And like, for example, I saw you had that Spaces with Dave Smith last week, I believe. And so forget the actual name of the caucus or the fact that there is a caucus, but let's call them the right wing or the
non-state supporters, people who don't like me, right?
What do I do? And let's face it too. It's not that they don't like you. I mean, maybe they don't, but I'm saying they also don't like what they perceive as left libertarianism, as opposed to this oxymoronic libertarian nationalism that I keep hearing about, which I still don't understand how those two words work together. Several people have tried to convince me in open dialogue, and I just don't get it. So, but you have to admit, the most vocal, the most perhaps annoying from my point of view, perhaps from yours as well, I won't put words in your mouth, faction, group of people, however you want to term it, are going to be the ones who are fighting for the soul of the party 4 years from now, in 2 years, when we have, when we try to vote leadership in again, you know, when McArdle and her crew are up for re-election, right? Are you able to deal with those people? And if so, how do you plan on bridging? Because I sense a lot of vitriol coming from that camp, whether it's, you know, the Jeremy Kaufmans of the world, the Heises of the world, the people who indeed have sold out to Trump. And we could also talk about how that's going, but who seem convinced that the only way the Libertarian Party moves forward is by becoming the minor league team, the AAA team for the Republican Party.
Let me speak to that a little bit. So first, there are some people who are just not going to be, I feel like, somebody who's ever going to give you, due respect in terms of me or, you know, the broad spectrum of libertarianism across left and right. Somebody who just absolutely, and you mentioned one of them in terms of Kaufman. I don't think that guy is ever going to really comport himself in a way that I feel is professional or ethical. In any kind of way, like, right, this is why I don't give that person a time of day. But there's plenty of people who are right over there who I do feel like could absolutely build something and could be a part of a libertarian party that everyone who really believes in true libertarianism belongs to. And I'm not trying to isolate a whole lot of those people. In fact, for me, and especially even those who maybe felt like this strategy that the chair McArdle has of, trying to gain influence with Trump, I think, as we've seen, that there is no real libertarian in that cabinet. Like, you can try to claim Robert Kennedy all she wants, but Robert Kennedy did not get that spot in the cabinet because Angela McArdle invited Donald Trump to come speak at our convention.
Of course, he
got that because Robert Kennedy stopped campaigning for himself and instead campaigned for Donald Trump. He earned that on his own, right? He got that seat at the table on his own. And so for us to try to claim that as some sort of like, oh, well, this is the plan all along, very dumb.
After getting rebuffed by Harris, by the way, I think that's the part people forget.
Yes.
He went to Harris first.
He was ready to sell out to Harris too. So that's the thing. Right. Like, and Kennedy to me is a politician. He's a, and he is definitely a born on third base, thought he hit a triple type. Right. So for me, not impressive to me to say that that's our libertarian in the cabin. And I think as people see how Donald Trump comports himself for the next 2 years with a Republican Senate, with a Republican House, and with a friendly conservative Supreme Court, of which he has appointed 1/3 of them, and we see the non-libertarian direction that this is going to go, and we see the growth of government that I will bet a lot that we're going to see growth of government, because we hear about reduction of government all the time and it never happens, right? And I don't think this is going to be any different. And maybe it is. And if it is, I'll be happy to see it. But if it isn't, there's going to be a lot of libertarians who felt betrayed by that strategy. And my job is not to be like, nanny, nanny, boo, boo, I told you so. It's to say, you know what? I get it. I get the fact that you wanted to take this gamble. You felt like this was maybe a shortcut towards influence. And I want you to recognize there are no shortcuts. We have to work hard together. We have to actually work hard and to build something that's an alternative to duopoly, because duopoly will always sell you out. And once they come to that realization, it is our job, for those of us who want to maintain the party and grow it and not see it as the JV team. It's not to say you were so stupid for doing that. It's to say, you know what? We get it. Get back in here and let's get to work. That's the attitude we need to be having for those. And that's the hand that I'll be extending to those across the spectrum. And if folks want to say I'm woke or whatever, they don't like me because of that or personality, there's some things I won't be able to change. But for everything that I can, I'm going to make an honest attempt to say, let's grow this party. Let's grow this movement. Let's grow this philosophy and not be the JV team for a failed GOP that our forefathers, our party ancestors knew in 1972. It's why they left Richard Nixon and because he dropped the gold standard and stayed in Vietnam. But let's recognize that the war parties haven't changed and fight for something better.
And you know, to be fair, I sort of painted with a broad brush when I said the Mises Caucus. There's a lot of folks in the Mises Caucus who disagreed with the way you were treated by McCardle and her leadership. Yep. I had Karen Ann Harlow's here for an interview, and she said, look, did I support Chase initially? No, but he's our candidate, and I have to support our party's candidate. And she was very upfront, and I gave her a lot of credit for having the integrity to stand up to her caucus mates with that whole Colorado affair, doing the right thing. And I just saw that she was exonerated. I think exonerated is the right word, by the Judiciary Committee, and they've restored her, I think, pending more litigation from McCardle. So so do you see yourself, though, having that potential with certain folks who were initially anti-Chase, who were initially in the Recktenwald camp or the Dave Smith camp, if you go one iteration previous? Do you, I understand you're going to try to be the bigger man here. You're going to try to reach out. Let's build some bridges. Let's build some lasting infrastructure to build out the party and to spread liberty. Do you feel there's enough folks on that other side that are willing to work with you?
I do. Listen, I'm an optimist. I wouldn't be doing what I do if I weren't an optimist, right? If I felt all was lost, I was a pessimist, I wouldn't be talking to you today. I would have just, you know, gotten a 9-to-5er and gotten right back. And, you know, no, I'm going to devote myself to building this party up over this next years, because I do believe there's a party that is worthy of being built up. I do believe there's a lot of people who want to see this party succeeding. And really maybe didn't agree with the strategy that the caucus went with this time with the backing of Trump and things like that. And or maybe over the time, they're going to see that maybe this wasn't the best strategy to take when they don't see government reduced, or when they see more wars, or, you know, the Fed not ending, or whatever it is that they, you know, whatever their concerns are, you know, on the whole, I would like to see them come back into this movement. And I think there are enough people for that. And I also think there's enough people who are going to be new voters to be able to replenish our party and build up our party over the long haul. Like, I don't, I don't think that this is an easy task by any means, but this is why I'm getting into it right now. That's why I decided to run for president at 39, because I think there's plenty of time for me to do my work as an ex-candidate, as an organizer, try to build this party up so that we see, you know, some libertarian wins across the board. That's my goal. Like, and yeah, there's definitely, I think, enough people for that.
Right. During the convention and leading up to the convention, the Libertarian Party convention, Lars Mapstead and Larry Sharp had put together a plan, or had offered up a plan about trying to capture one state electorally, get one electoral vote in one. I think they had targeted Montana, if I'm not mistaken.
And Nebraska.
Nebraska, right. Anywhere where there's a split of, it's not a winner take all, first past the poll type of thing. What do you think of a strategy like that? And is that something that you might consider in the future?
Well, you know, I think that strategy maybe makes sense for a party that is more regionally based, right? Like if you have a party that has a huge base, say, in like one area of the country, because it's a party that maybe that's to the interest of rural voters and farmers, right? And so you're in that breadbasket of America and you can gain that vote in Nebraska, say. Or if it's a party that's devoted to like maritime trade and living on the coast up there in Maine, where they split their vote, that is a very possibility. But in order to do that, you have to build a very strong state affiliate party to do that. Like, I think if we want to see that happening in Nebraska and Maine, which are the only two states that currently do this, I wish every state did it, right? But if we want to see that in Nebraska and Maine, we have to build up the Nebraska and Maine parties to be strong enough to support fully a presidential campaign at that level. And I love both of those parties, and I want to see them be built up. I don't think the national party is nationally there yet. And so I want to see ourselves building that up. But I would love to see LP Maine and LP Nebraska be able to really fund and field that kind of campaign in those districts, because there is potential there, right? You know, the idea is if you deny the 270, which in a very close race you could, it wouldn't have mattered in this race, right? It would have been great. Hey, we got one electoral vote, but Trump's still the president by a long shot because Kamala Harris got blown out, right, in every single state. But if it were very, very close, the idea is that you would have that deciding factor. And you could convince your elector to vote for one or the other if one or the other was to say, I will do this for the Libertarian Party, for your elector to vote for whoever they want to, right? That's kind of the idea. And it has legs, but we'd have to have the party infrastructure to get it done. And hey, that's what I'm focused on doing over the next 4 years, building up that party infrastructure.
Would you consider running like for chair of the party, or would your interest only be as a candidate for office?
You know, I've been asked about running for chair a whole lot. You know, I don't think I have the resume really to be the best chair. I have not chaired a statewide affiliate. You know, I've sat on the boards of nonprofits. I've been on my state's executive committee. I've been a candidate myself, which is kind of running a whole national thing, in partnership with my campaign manager, my staff. Right. But really what I want to see is somebody who's really running a really good state libertarian affiliate or a fantastically run nonprofit step up to do the work of being our party chair. Somebody who has the temperament to work on a board, which is, you know, when you're a candidate, I can kind of say whatever I want. Whatever, what I say goes when you're the campaign, right? When you're the chair of a committee, you have to have the temperament to not govern by executive fiat. You have to be able to work with people to do the job properly anyway. And so that's what I want to see is who's a great state chair or a great head of a nonprofit who wants to step up and do this. But I'm not against possibly serving on on the national committee or my state's executive committee. I would love to do those things, be part of the deliberative body, bringing in that insight that I have as a candidate who's run now district wide, statewide, and nationally. Let's bring that insight into the picture. But no, I don't have any plans to run for chair right now. Maybe that change my mind changes one day, but today and going into Grand Rapids, I don't believe that's the path for me.
Okay, fair enough. One of the things during the campaign that you were accused of, and when I asked Mike about it, he vehemently denied it, but I'm going to give you an opportunity to confirm or deny. There was these things that you were ducking certain podcast invitations for whatever reason. Either you were afraid to confront the hosts, the Tim Pools of the world, whatever, the Dave Smiths or whatever. Mike said you were never invited to attend those podcasts. Is that true? Or were you invited? Did you decline? Were you never invited? Because they keep painting you in a bad light, like you were ducking confrontation. You were ducking, quote unquote, the tough questions. Like you hear that from the Dave Smiths. You hear that from like a lot of the right wing libertarians. Can you just for the people listening and watching, can you just put that to bed one way or another?
Well, yeah. First off, as far as ducking tough questions, I don't think anybody who sees me get interviewed by Luke Radowski, which I did, would say I ducked tough questions. I took a lot of tough questions along this campaign. From a lot of different people, but that's just one example, right? I know somebody who vehemently disagreed with me was sitting in on that podcast and asking questions, right, and challenging a lot of things. But as far as the two you mentioned, Tim Pool is pretty simple. Tim Pool originally had asked me to come on his, not his main show, but like his secondary show called Culture War and argue with Jeremy Kaufman. which I felt is not a very good use of a campaign's time for me to sit in on a guy who's certifiably nuts and would like to just yell the words gay, race, communist at me for 2 hours, right? Like, I don't feel the need to, you know, to give airtime to that, certainly not as a presidential campaign. So what we said to Tim Pool is, hey, you know, we're not interested in doing that, but we would love to be interviewed one-on-one on your main show the way you did with Robert Kennedy and Donald Trump. Because we're a presidential campaign. We want to have that same kind of access and let Tim one-on-one have a conversation with Chase without having somebody who's aggressively anti-Chase barking on the other side of the screen, right?
Well, I'll say it for you. He's a bigot. Kaufman's a bigot. I'll say it for you.
So, like, that was kind of where we were at with Tim Pool. And we never got a response back to doing that one-on-one. And, you know, in my mind, I felt like they didn't want me to be able to do that. They just wanted to be able to have that first show they wanted me to be on. So that was that. As far as Dave Smith, you know, our media coordinator for Mike had reached out to Dave Smith, weren't interested, apparently. And as far as me, I was called out on Twitter to do the thing. And basically what all we said was, hey, get with our media person, book a time, we'll do it. And that just never happened. There was no coordination between those two groups. Dave's people never reached out to my people, right? And I don't make my schedule. I don't decide when I do podcasts. When you're running a national campaign, you have to rely on a team to do those things, because otherwise you're going to double book yourself, or you're going to book yourself when you're supposed to be on an airplane or in a car or somewhere else. So you have to rely on a whole team of people to do that for you. And so that is kind of the nature of that. Why did I go on Dave Smith's space after the election when I got called out on Twitter? Well, because you have a little bit more time, free time, after the presidential campaign to kind of do that stuff more informally. And so, no, it's not about answering tough questions. Again, I took plenty of tough questions from plenty of people, not just in the libertarian sphere either, across the left-right spectrum. I went on some shows with people who are very much to the left of the Libertarian Party and challenged those notions. Went on traditionally conservative outlets. Heck, I you know, so I went kind of anywhere that would have me, so long as we kind of did it through the channel of having somebody book me so I knew where I was supposed to be at the right time. And that's where I'm at. And so, you know, I'm not afraid to talk to people about tough stuff. If you've ever been at a libertarian convention with me, after the drinks start flowing or when folks are outside enjoying their vape or what have you, out by the fire, I've gotten into plenty of spirited discussions. You know, so it's not a matter of not being able to afraid to defend your record. It's a matter of what's the best use of my time. Arguing with someone you call a bigot, you know, that's not a great use of a time.
Right. Yeah. And honestly, they wouldn't expect Trump or Harris to argue with the bigots of their factions either. Right. So to your point that, you know, I think they were just looking for the quick confrontation, the sensationalism of it all. And good for you for not doing that personally, because I don't think you would have been well served by that. It would have just come down to a lot of name calling, at least on one end. So good. And I'm glad I got to ask you that directly and you gave me your honest answer, because I always tell people, people who have come up to me and said, why is he? I don't know. Anytime I reach out to him, it's always like, call Amber, set up a time and we'll get it done. You know, you've always been very receptive to me, and I'm like basically not a big time guy. I don't see why you would have avoided the exposure of a Tim Pool. It's illogical. So I'm glad.
There's a giant contact us thing for anybody who ever wants to book us, but also it's not as if we weren't reaching out either. We of course were also reaching out to the folks like Rogan, and I would love to have done Theo Von. I think Theo Von would have had a great conversation with me. Two good old boys just kicking it. You know, there's a lot of podcasters out in that sphere that I would love to speak to about libertarianism, about the concepts of non-aggression, the philosophy of liberty, that I think would be well served. It just is a matter of, you know, a lot of people were very, very, again, siloed into that two-party mindset in this election. And, you know, maybe they weren't wanting to give oxygen, right? And I can't speak to that. And sometimes it's also a matter of you got to have a product to be pushing, like, you know, a book or, you know, a project of some kind.
Right.
It's not just enough to be a candidate sometimes for these things. Well, we'll have projects going forward that can maybe help with that. But right now, you know, I can't be angry. I can't be bitter, and I can't Monday morning quarterback the entire thing. All I can say is it was a hell of a ride. I had a great time. I worked as hard as I could, and I had a great team who was working just as hard. And my job now is to build the party going forward so the whoever it is, man or woman, next time they come around and want to do this in 4 years, whoever it may be, whether it's me or anybody else, I want to make sure they have a better time, an easier time, and have a bigger impact. So that's what I'm focusing on.
And I'm glad to hear that because you're looking at the upside of things, and I think that's a very healthy outlook. So give me, like, if you have anything in mind, what's the first thing you want to attempt? Like, what would you think would be the first type of action you will take towards what you just mentioned?
Yeah, well, I have a few different irons in the fire in terms of projects that I want to work on. Some of them are not even libertarian related. Like, some is just, you know, me and another guy who is very much in the Libertarian Party and worked for another campaign during the primary process, libertarians, and we both agreed to each other, hey, when this thing is done, no matter who the candidate is after November, let's start a podcast that's not libertarian. That's more related to something we like, which is Star Trek. So
Look
for that. I'll be in the podcasting space, hopefully doing that pretty soon. But then we're looking to form some sort of an organization. We're looking at kind of what, you know, what kind of organizational structure fits the best. You know, there's a lot of different options out there, whether you're a PAC, a nonprofit, or what have you, to see what really can come about, the twofold vision of, one, really putting out libertarian policy in the face of a Donald Trump who is likely to act in a very unlibertarian manner, not just saying, hey, and again, and I want to preface this, I want Ross to be free. I do. I want him to be free on day one. And if Donald Trump frees him on day one, that's great. But then we have 364 more days in that year to hold him accountable and 3 more years after that to hold him accountable, right? And so we need somebody who's going to be doing that. And so I'm going to have an organization that's focused on that, as well as identifying people who are being screwed over locally by their government, locally by the powers that be, and doing what we can to shine a light on that and to create short form documentaries and news segments that we can then bring out to let people see exactly what's going on, focus the attention where it needs to be, where people are being abused by their government, and be a voice and a spotlight for those people who need that. So those are kind of the twofold missions that I'm going to be looking forward to in 2025 and beyond. Exactly what form that takes is still to be seen. We're still in the planning stages. And then lastly, you know, I'm starting live streaming. So if you want to see me every 2 weeks, every other Tuesday, I'm on X, YouTube, and Facebook. And then every other Tuesday, I'm going to start being on TikTok Live. And so it'll be, you'll either find me where the kids are or where all of us millennials and above are hanging out. So, you know, whichever part of the ideological or age spectrum you fall on, you can find me live streaming at least once a week.
Yeah. And let's make sure nobody cuts that out and uses it out of context. Of age kids. You'll be where the of age kids are hanging out, Chase.
When I say the kids, I mean those young TikTokers who are doing their stupid dances and stuff like that. But I'm way, my joints and my back just do not have the ability to do those dances. I wish TikTok had been around 20 years ago in the MySpace years. It would be a whole different thing. But you know, nowadays, what I can do is I can sit down like I'm doing right now, live stream, talk about the news, and kind of bring a libertarian perspective to a whole group of younger people who are able to hopefully vote and get out there and change the world. So like, that's kind of my focus on doing TikTok, which is speaking to that audience that I don't think libertarians are really, a lot of political parties take the time to really speak to.
Right. No, that's great. It's actually very, very strategic and very smart of you to try to do that. And speaking of old joints, I saw a post you had on X earlier this week about DDP yoga. Diamond Dallas Page. Now, being an old wrestling guy, I actually worked with some of the old school wrestlers back when I was a lot younger, like the Sergeant Slaughters of the world. Do you do DDP yoga? Do you know Dallas Page? Where did that come from? Just out of curiosity, though.
Yeah, I haven't met Dallas Page, but I have done DDP yoga in the past. I'm starting to get back into it as I recommit myself to fitness. You know, when you run for president, you eat a lot of junk food. You don't have enough time to work out on the road, and your body kind of feels like crap by the end of it. So I'm doing what I can to change myself and hopefully start working out more. And so DDP yoga is going to be a part of that. But really what got me into it is I watched a short form documentary on YouTube about how he had brought back two wrestlers that were part of my youth, Buff Bagwell and Scotty Riggs. I'd already seen him help Jake the Snake Roberts and Scott Hall, but seeing Buff Bagwell and Scotty Riggs both come out of that, it's like you realize how many people in that industry he has helped And not just him, but also all the, not just them, but also all the people who utilize the program to improve their health. I really think that that guy, you know, deserves his own award in the WWE Hall of Fame. Like, he doesn't just need to be a Hall of Famer. You know, right. They need to have a Diamond Dallas Page Award for people who go out of their way to do good for people, yes, in that industry, because he has saved and extended the lives of so many people. Right. And even like folks like Chris Jericho, who's an older wrestler, but is still able to go and do the thing because he got himself healthy because of DDP yoga. So I recommend anybody out there, and I don't get paid a dime by Diamond Dallas Page. Trust me, I wish I did. I wish I knew the guy. But what I can say is he does amazing work. And if you want to work out and get fit and get trim and improve your circulation, your flexibility, your core strength, DDP yoga, DDPY is a great program to do that.
Yeah. I've always been an admirer of his, ironically, since he retired. Like, as a wrestler, I don't know that, yeah, I followed him that closely, but you know, you just mentioned Buff Bagwell and Scotty Riggs, the American Males, the tag team, the American Males, if I recall correctly, in WCW, one of the regional things down south. So it's good to see that I have a fellow wrestling fan that I'm interviewing here.
Oh, I'm a huge wrestling fan. In fact, I'm part of the Libertarian Party Professional Wrestling Caucus group on Facebook. I recommend wrestling fans who are libertarians check it out. And by the way, I even got into, you know, being a politician, you get into Twitter spats with people. Crazily enough, I got into a Twitter spat with the wrestler known as Val Venus. He's a big time election denier, believes that Trump won in 2020, also believes that LGBTQ people are all groomers and sexualized children. Coming from a guy who was, his gimmick was being an adult film star in an arena full of children, it is quite ironic. But anyway, I digress. But wrestling is a great thing to talk about. Well, we can talk only about wrestling next time we do this. How about that?
Perfect, because I grew up in the industry a little bit, and as a fan, as an entrepreneur, so I would love to talk to you about it. Of course, my references are probably 25 years older than yours, but fair enough. But Chase Oliver, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great. I'm going to put up your X handle for the folks who want to follow you. Follow Chase. Chase, is there anything, any website or anything you want to promote before we go up there?
Well, yeah. Well, you can actually find me at Chase for Liberty on all of the major platforms. If you search that out, that should take you to me on TikTok, X, Facebook, YouTube, and elsewhere. But also, right now, I am trying to finish out my presidential campaign, close out all the bills, get all the invoices paid, make sure it's done by December the 31st so I don't have to have my treasurer file with the FEC into 2025. We want to let him have a life again, people. So if you can go to votechaseoliver.com and feel the need to donate, that will help us make sure all invoices get paid, everything gets done, and we close up shop responsibly and ethically a way a presidential campaign should. And then, go to those social media handles, and stay tuned for what might be coming for the future, because big stuff coming in 2025.
Absolutely. Everyone, Chase Oliver, our 2024 candidate for president of the Libertarian Party. Chase, thank you so much. And again, as you get these projects in the future, let's have you back on the show. We'd love to talk to you about them. We'd love to help you promote your stuff. Always good to help a fellow believer in liberty to get out there and do some great stuff. So everyone, until then, this has been Big John on Free For All on the Grumblings Media Network. Don't forget to join us every Thursday for another episode of Free For All. Go to grumblingsmedia.com for all past episodes and our other great shows like Fired Up, our conservative show hosted by William Del Pilar. Until next time, everyone, peace out.